Lewis is currently competing for the NDP leadership role against Union leader Rob Ashton, Campbell River City Councillor Tennille Johnson, Green Progressive Tony McQuail, and sitting MP for Edmonton Strathcona Heather McPherson. Only registered members of the Federal New Democratic Party can vote for the next party leader and must be members by January 28th to be eligible to vote in March. After the membership deadline, an English language leadership debate is scheduled for February 19th in Metro Vancouver. For CHY News, produced with files from Jesse Woodward, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade, unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
This is BirdNote. For folks looking to try birding for the first time, getting started can be daunting. Should you learn every species call, every subtle feather pattern before you head out to look for birds? While it's good to prepare, there's a risk of scaring yourself out of starting and preventing the kind of hands-on experiential learning that's one of the best parts of birding. So when you have the time and energy, just go for it. Learning about birds is the work of a lifetime. That's why it's so rewarding. And there are great tools to help you out. Bringing a field guide with you is a time-tested approach. Even the experts turn to a field guide when they're stumped. Newer tools like the Merlin Bird ID app help identify which species you're seeing or hearing right on your phone. And if you can find another birder or a group to tag along with, all the better. You can learn from people with more experience and share the joys and struggles with fellow newbies. For many people, talking to other birders is nearly as fun as finding the birds. For BirdNote, I'm Jonice Franklin.
And we are back with Speak Up Only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This next piece is coming out of Smithers, BC. It is about the ambulance paramedics of BC who are currently taking job action and how that may affect the north of the province.
This is CICK News.
My name is Ian Tate. I'm the communications director for the Ambulance Paramedics of BC.
Today on CICK News, I spoke with Ian Tate on Tuesday following reports that APBC members may be moving toward job action. At the center of the dispute, stalled contract negotiations, staffing shortages, and growing pressure on paramedics as emergency rooms close and ambulance crews increasingly fill gaps in rural and remote healthcare across the province. Let's hear my conversation with Ian Tate now.
Yes, we've had a pretty substantial breakdown at the bargaining table over the last 6 weeks, which is really unfortunate because we've had a lot of direction from members about what we're looking for, what are important to paramedics and dispatchers, and what we consider to be really important issues for healthcare in BC right now. We obviously, when we come to the bargaining table, we talk about wages and benefits and compensation, and there's a lot more at stake this time because of just ongoing issues with ER closures and rural and remote BC, and staffing these areas has always been a challenge. And now when we are being asked to do more and more every year, it's more important now than ever that we need to appropriately invest in the ambulance service so that we can put an end to some of those challenges.
You touched on a few of them, ER closures. I can hear already a lot of frustration in your voice. It could be because this is your 10th interview about this today, but would you mind giving me some just, yeah, real specifics about what this experience has been like for paramedics in BC and what you're seeing services or kind of barriers that you're just, you can't really put up with anymore?
We consider it to be an issue of pressure. So we've been asked to do more and more every year as paramedics and dispatchers. So 5 years ago, helping communities when the hospital was closed wasn't a thing. It used to just be 911 calls, helping people on transfers. That was our bread and butter. Now we're providing such high level care across the province, a million square kilometers, 24/7. We've become such a big part of the healthcare system, of public safety, of emergency response. And we've worked collaboratively with the government to essentially rebuild the ambulance service in the last decade. And we're really proud of that. But when you look at, say, what happened during COVID, the ongoing opioid epidemic that's never ended, when you look at staffing shortages, when an ER closes in a small town, the ambulance station, we become the healthcare system. And we're now taken out of our communities for significant amount of times going to neighboring communities to make sure our patients get the health that they need and the care that they need. And sometimes there are no other ambulances in town when we leave. So we're being asked to do more every year. To be honest with you, we are more than happy to do that. This is why we joined this profession, why we've joined this career. But at the same time, we need to be compensated appropriately. We need mental health and wellness supports that are appropriate. We need contracting out language that's more sustainable for us. And we need to be able to recruit and retain more staff now than ever.
Mm-hmm. You used a term that I'm not sure, contracting out language, is that what you said?
Yeah. So, you know, there's multiple different private agencies throughout BC that are being contracted to do our work, whether it's helicopter agencies or private transfer services. These things are all outside privatized healthcare that are taking work away from some of our paramedics. And we don't think that's appropriate. It's a two-tier system. It costs a lot of money when we're already in place. So we understand that BC EHS paramedics can't do absolutely everything, but we don't like seeing other agencies that have an agenda kind of take our work. We want to make sure that the ambulance service is funded appropriately and that the taxes that we all pay for the ambulance service go to the ambulance service and not to outside agencies.
Yeah, absolutely. But your unionized has reached a consensus on what form job action might look like and if there's a timeline, if you can share.
So job action for us is very different than what people conjure up in their head, right? It's not like the old days, like we work for a mine and we go on strike and there's a picket line and we stop work. That's not how we want to operate. We're under the essential service orders that are currently being set. That dictates what we can do as far as staffing and coming to work looks like. And quite frankly, none of us want to reduce the amount of ambulances that are on the road. We do this to be major partners in healthcare and public safety in the communities that we work and live. We don't want to put ambulances out of service, but there are other ways with escalating job action, even just overtime issues. Like this province runs on overtime as far as the ambulance service goes, and we are never staffed 100%. Of the time. What we really want is arbitrator, someone like Vince Reddy, to be appointed and bring both parties back to the table and hammer out a collective agreement.
You've gone to the bargaining table once, but was it a stalemate or what was it that kind of resulted in?
No, you mean just recently, like this year?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So we've been in contract negotiations September.
Okay.
We've actually got a significant amount of like peripheral stuff agreed to in principle. We're actually really proud of a lot of the initiatives that we've brought to the table that have huge cost savings for the government. So when we do stuff like that, we believe there's money available there to help with compensation and benefits and mental health and wellness supports. Like, the money needs to be there. But currently, right now, we're being offered less than public sector unions like the BCGEU. And when we look at what we bring to the table and what the ambulance service means to British Columbians, we are really frustrated by that. So we want to come back to the table. We want the government to take it more seriously, and we're ready to go anytime.
Now, what does the timeline look like?
We have never refused a meeting to meet at the bargaining table. So we are ready. We understand there's always a lull during the Christmas season, but when they gave us their, what they consider their final offer in November, which we took as significantly disrespectful, we have not had any dates since then. So we are willing to meet, and we're ready to finish negotiating and finalize a contract at any time.
Okay. Like I said, because I am here in the north, I'm in the Skeena region. And as we were speaking about possibly even before we were recording, just how remote our communities are from each other, and even the state of some of our, like our Kitwanga ambulance station, yeah. Just like there's a lot of repair that's needed as well. Oh,
does that even exist anymore, that station?
It's, I know
that
it's still
in a significant
disrepair. Yeah, so it does because it has to, but there's just not really a response yet as to... The fundraising has been going on for years, and it's just really been in this kind of nebulous zone.
What do you mean by fundraising?
It's a community group that they hold these fundraising events to try to, like, I think it's like to do repairs on the current station.
That's really sad, and I'll tell you why. We pay provincial taxes to the government to provide and deliver an ambulance service. The fact that private citizens have to come forward with money to build a government-owned building, especially on an Indigenous community, is embarrassing. It's embarrassing. And the facilities throughout BC, when it comes to BCEHS, are abysmal. Like, you go to any community, and I challenge any reader or listener, you go to any community in British Columbia and you look at a fire hall, and you look at the corresponding ambulance station, and 99 times out of 100, the ambulance station will be a dump and the fire hall will be some beautiful $5 million building. And I understand that obviously there's different funding models there, and it's municipal versus provincial, but most of our buildings are from the 70s. They got out of a lot of the ownership stuff, and they rent a lot of the places, but we know from across the province that there are a lot of stations in complete shambles and that are condemned or even should be condemned. And that's really embarrassing. But I can tell you that BCEHS's strategic plan had a commitment to increase their exposure and coverage on Indigenous communities. And I think they would be very hard pressed to say that they're meeting that objective. But the idea that private citizens should be fundraising, and even organizations, to build an ambulance station that our tax dollars are already earmarked to be providing. So we say this thing that, oh, it's the service so nice that you get to pay for it twice, where municipalities pay a lot of their fire departments to do emergency medical calls now.
Yeah.
And you're like, listen, the ambulance service is mandated to provide that service. And the vast majority of fire departments now that do medical service, it's completely taking over their fire departments because BCEHS is failing so badly at providing the service. So now it's the service that's so nice that you get to pay for it in your provincial taxes, and now your municipal property taxes via the fire department are offsetting medical costs as well.
Last question just specifically about this is just if you have a collected kind of thought through message that you have for the provincial government about what you need to happen at the bargaining table in order to avoid a strike.
Yeah. Yes. What we want is we would love to see a mediator appointed to get both parties back on track. We want the government to recognize the service that we are providing and how much work paramedics are now responsible for. If you look at our scope of practice, our responsibility, let alone the level of pressure that is put on our members now compared to just 5 or 10 years ago, it's a different ambulance service. It's a completely different scenario. So we are not asking for anything outlandish. We are just asking for a base level of respect for the work that we already provide.
Thank you to Ian Tate, Director of Communications for the Ambulance and Paramedics of BC. If you're just tuning in, as BC ambulance paramedics consider job action, concerns are mounting about what that could mean for rural and northern communities. Ongoing staffing shortages, reliance on overtime, and long-distance ambulance transfers have already stretched emergency services thin, particularly in places like Kitwanga, where the ambulance station is aging and crews are often pulled away to serve neighboring communities. I spoke with Bulkley Valley Stikine MLA Sharon Hartwell about the possibility of a strike, what they're hearing from paramedics on the ground, and why she says the North continues to feel overlooked, despite provincial claims of increased funding and hiring for ambulance services. Let's hear that conversation now.
How are you feeling about all this?
I'm very disappointed, actually, because we've been talking about this a long time. I've had this conversation about Kitwanga, which is just a prime example in the North of what's happening. And I can only feel very sad for the paramedics and the firemen and all these people that are out constantly. I was going to say it's worse in the cities than up here, but I'm not sure it is. It's just different. Yeah. So they're constantly on call. They're completely in overtime all the time. And it's interesting because Minister Josie Osborne in the House, when I keep bringing up Kitwanga and the lack of services in the North, she was very proud to say that they've spent, increased their budget for paramedics over $1 billion. They've increased hiring by 40%. So my question to her was, we're not seeing that in the North. Mm-hmm. If they're doing that, why now are the paramedics still having to fight for better mental health, better care, a more reasonable lifestyle, life balance? When you're seeing ambulances go from Burns Lake to Houston or Houston to Burns Lake, Houston to Smithers, Smithers to Houston, etc. So these paramedics are working extraordinary hours with the opioid crisis, with all these things that they're dealing with, and up here, driving back and forth, up and down the road, taking resources from one community to the other, It's simply unacceptable, Really unacceptable.
So if job action, if it limits overtime, rural communities are going to be hit really hard by that. So what would be your party's plan to ensure reliable ambulance coverage?
What we were going to have to do is continue to engage the minister in saying this is completely unacceptable. Systematically, throughout the whole health system, they're starting to, as my colleague would say, ration health care. But you know what? People need health care. They're paying their taxes. The government isn't rationing what they're asking for. They're asking for more. So as far as we're concerned, then obviously they need to step up to the plate and put the money where it's most needed. And I certainly hope they get some of the things that they're asking for, because they're the ones on the ground that are helping. Up north, that's their hospital. You ask Kitwanga, and they say, if we have an ambulance station, as far as they're concerned, that's their hospital. That's the only health care that they've got. And they serve three other communities, First Nations communities. This is completely unacceptable. With the amount of resources that come out of the North, this is how we're served. We're completely underserved, and it's becoming dangerous.
In a concrete way, how does your party want to address this? Aside from bringing it to the House, what concrete suggestions is your party thinking that you want to bring to the table to address issues exactly like Kitwanga?
Well, the only thing we can do is keep talking to and demonstrating the need. But the other thing is that I find it interesting that the regional district in Kitimat-Stikine, which is part, that area is part in my riding and part in the other riding, every year that they've made requests for funding, they have been denied. So why are the local people there on the ground within the regional districts not supporting this project? So they have the land, they have everything they need. They just need to complete part of the project. So there was an interesting conversation that Sharon and I had about having somebody build to lease. So there are options that we're looking at, but the bottom line is the government needs to take accountability for what's going on in the North. Across the province for sure, but my responsibility is for the North. And I think that they've downplayed or made us not invisible, but hoped that we would be, and it's not going to happen anymore. Because if they want the Golden Triangle to be their golden goose as far as balancing the budget and getting things, that's fine. Great. Let's get on with permitting mines. Let's get on with getting forestry back on track. Let's get on with these things so we can have health care and paramedics are going to be adequately compensated for what they're doing, or at least have a good life balance. So for me right now, it's find an immediate, some kind of an answer to help them start construction of this site. And people will come to the table. They've been very generous. The mining companies in the north have been very generous to this community. They've had bake sales, they've had bingos, they've had all kinds of things. Since when is that? Plus paying your taxes, not good enough to invest in health care in the north.
This is something that I got from my interview with Ian Tate, was that we're seeing more private contractors used for things like patient transfers for both ground and air services. But again, like our paramedics, they're stretched thin. But should the government be directly investing in more public ambulance services in order to address private contractors coming in and doing the work of ambulance to transfer patients?
I appreciate the help that they're getting, but no, if we're paying taxes for healthcare, we deserve to have healthcare. And I know that there's a group in Telqua that does emergency services, but it's by contract or by hire. So it's not like going out and saying, do you want your knee fixed? You can do it faster if you're going to go to a private clinic and get it done, if you can afford to do that. So if people can afford to do that, or companies can afford to hire these people, I think that's one small step in the loop. But I do believe it's the government's responsibility to start with the basics, which is building the building so that we can have ambulances, whether it's going to be ground transfers or not. So as much as having contractors fill the void, some communities maybe can afford that and some can't, but I don't think it's the community's responsibility to do that, it's the government's.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a box of cereal says best before July 3rd, that does not mean it will go bad on July 3rd. Food date labels vary, and in most cases they do not indicate that food is unsafe to eat. For example, the label best before marks when food is at peak quality, and the label sell by indicates when stores should take it off the shelf. But in a recent survey, Ronnie Neff of Johns Hopkins University found that many Americans mistakenly believe that they should immediately throw food out after its labeled date. And according to the nonprofit ReFed, a partner on the survey, this causes a lot of food waste.
They estimated that confusion about date labels is leading U.S. consumers to discard about 3 billion pounds of food per year.
That's a problem for the climate. Growing and shipping all that wasted food emits carbon pollution. And as it rots in a landfill, it emits climate warming methane.
That's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions that didn't need to happen.
ReFed estimates that standardizing food date labels to clarify their meaning could save over 400,000 tons of food each year and prevent as much carbon pollution as taking 500,000 gas cars off the road. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're nearing the end of this hour, and I want to thank you all so much for tuning in. But before we end off and move on to Democracy Now!, I thought I would play a couple more tracks from bands featured at Unreal City Fest coming January 15th to 17th at the Russian Hall and Rickshaw Theater in Vancouver, so that you can get a better idea of the lineup. So we're going to be playing another band that also was pretty prominent in the charts last year here at CJSF. This is Bloom Effect with Armor. We'll be right back.
now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. During the 80s and the 90s, CJSF would come into its own as a serious platform for independent artists and a forum for people to express ideas not present in the mainstream media. Summer 2002, CJSF receives a license from the Canadian Radio Telecommunications Commission to broadcast over the FM airwaves. February 13th, 2003, 7 p.m. CJSF goes on air at 90.1 FM, and we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
Okay, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That last track was from Bloom Effect, titled Armor, and you can listen to them and that track at Unreal City Fest, which is happening January 15th to 17th. Imagine that song live. Imagine so many songs live with so many amazing artists, such as, again, Devours, Worrywart, Buddy, Houseplants, which you heard an interview of earlier this hour with our programming coordinator, Jesse, and his co-host for the Vancouver Mixtape, Jamie. There are a lot more interviews coming your way this week, so stay tuned for all of that. And make sure you stay tuned for the amazing programming we have coming up today. We've got Raccoon City. We've got a rerun of Typically Tuesdays coming your way. A few interesting open mics. And that is all for this afternoon. Thank you all so much for tuning in this week. And make sure you stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up in right about a few seconds. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Amy.